Don't get in a rush, Ms. Horde. I like for the courtroom to clear before you have to come to the lectern, okay? Yes. And feel free to take your water with you to the lectern. Okay, we're going to hear a Coney Landing Property LLC versus the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. We'll begin with Ms. Horde.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Vivian Horde, and I represent the partnership in this case. The partners were represented individually. Congress granted taxpayers an incentive to conserve developable land. In exchange, they were supposed to receive a deduction equal to the lost development cost of donating the land. They can conserve the land by placing what's called a qualified conservation contribution on the land. That's defined in 170 subsection H. That's what Oconee did a decade ago. However, since that time, the IRS keeps changing the goalposts and moving them.
Well, let's talk about the code.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the code says that the taxpayer must substantiate the value of the donation by supplying a qualified appraisal, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I understand it, that the tax court here found that the Reynoldses knew that the entire parent tract was worth considerably less than $10 million, and that there was a meeting of minds that the parent tract would be appraised before carve-outs very close to $60 million. Now, that's a finding of fact that the tax court made, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I would like to point out...
Well, so because it's a finding of fact, we have to review it for clear error, right? So if there's evidence to support that finding, the tax court has to be affirmed, it seems to me.
Your Honor?
Yep.
I would like to point out that the qualified appraisal requirement is based on a regulation that might be suspect under the APA, but that regulation requires three things. And the court committed legal error because the court didn't even apply the correct rule under the regulations. Under the regulations, the donor, which would be the Reynolds, who had developed through Linger Longer the area around Lake Oconee with the Ritz-Carlton and all the development that's around Lake Oconee, Mr. Reynolds is an owner. He would know what the value of the property is. He's in receivership, so he's not able to realize that value on his own. The Supreme Court's already recognized that a distressed seller is not a fair market value seller. But in addition, the donor must have knowledge of facts, and those facts would have to cause a reasonable person to believe that the appraisers would lie on the appraisal. Now, what the court ignored was the reasonable person standard. What would a reasonable person know about the area around Lake Oconee? Unlike the court, a reasonable person would go down there and look at the land, and they would see that there's a hospital adjacent to the land. They would see there's a school adjacent to the land. They would have done their due diligence, and they would have recognized that Robert Charles Lesser and Company had done a feasibility study on the land before the crash, and that feasibility study had established that the highest and best use of this land was middle market housing, because when you go down there, there's no place to live, no place for anyone who works at the Ritz-Carlton to live. A reasonable person would also have listened to the testimony of Judge Mr. Gaudet, who explained how the court had to consider these bank appraisals that were introduced, and would have to consider that when you have someone in receivership, that the bank's going to be doing a liquidation value appraisal, not a fair market value appraisal. A reasonable person would also know that national retailers are not coming into the area. National retailers like Home Depot and Publix aren't going to be coming into the area without their own feasibility studies.
Let me ask you something, Ms. Horde.
Yes, Your Honor.
Between 2013 and 2015, the Reynoldses attempted to sell the parent tract, didn't they?
No, they did not, Your Honor. They never attempted to sell the parent tract. They attempted to go into a joint venture because Mercer Reynolds knew that the property had value. If you've been to the area, you know this property has value. And you know that it there is middle market housing that's needed there. They need to have apartments and condos and townhomes for people who work at the Ritz-Carlton and work at the golf courses and work at the marinas. They have none of that there. Robert Charles Lesser had already determined that this was a good area to put it. Now, the government's expert says, oh, no, it's going to be luxury housing just like you have all over the lake. No one's waiting on this property to be luxury housing. It's never going to be luxury housing. If somebody wants luxury housing, they're going to buy in one of the luxury gated communities, or they're going to buy on the lake.
Well, if I understand your argument, it seems like the tax court rejected the investment strategy as just window dressing, and that your clients, based on the record all along, intended to follow what the court really kind of identified as a scheme to benefit from this tax deduction. So I guess, what is the import of your discussion regarding the investment potential when the court rejected that out of hand?
Well, I really can't tell what the court reviewed and relied on and what the court didn't rely on, because over 550 documents were received in evidence, and I really don't know what the court relied on. But an owner's has an opinion of value, and that's valid, and the law says the owner can have an opinion of value. And when the owner's trying to figure out how this thing is going to be structured, they let Strategic know what they think the opinion of value is. Now, the court seems to think there's some kind of ruse going on from the moment they met in February. Yeah. But if you look at exhibit...
Let's go back. In early 2013, Phoenix sent the Reynoldses a letter of intent, which valued the parent tract at $8.3 million, right?
And it was never signed, Your Honor. And
I know,
letter
they
of
were unable to reach a deal. Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Later that year, the Reynoldses attempted to form a joint venture, right, with another developer called TPA Group, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The Reynoldses' proposal, which TPA rejected, would have valued the parent tract at $7.9 million.
Your Honor, that's not valuing the parent tract. You've got to look at the highest and best use of the parent tract. That may be their basis in the property. But if you're doing a deal... The deal people want to know what the value of the property is before they put in the money.
Am I right that TPA counteroffered for $2.8 million for the entire parent tract and the Reynolds rejected that?
Yes, Your Honor. And the law is clear that offers do not establish value at all. What the court also ignored here is two local appraisers who valued the property based on its highest and best use. And
I'm not saying it's worth $2.8 million. What I'm suggesting to you is what I said to start it off with, was that this is some of the evidence to support the notion that between 2013 and 2015, the Reynoldses are attempting to sell the parent tract for between $6.7 and $7.9 million.
Your Honor, there is no evidence that they're trying to sell. I'm sure Mr. Reynolds would have liked to have had a joint venture and realized the full highest and best use market value, fair market value of his real estate. But the Supreme Court in Resolution Trust Corporation, I believe it was, said that if you're looking for fair market value, you have to have a reasonable... For fair market value is defined as the price at which a property would change hands between a reasonable buyer and a reasonable seller, neither under any compulsion to buy or sell, and both having equal knowledge. The Reynolds were in receivership. The property had loans against it. The bank was valuing it every year to see if they needed to foreclose on it and what would their liquidation value be. Nothing the Reynolds did during this period of time can conceivably be considered as anything reflecting fair market value.
Well, tell me about the authorization that they gave to a broker named Ted Baker. Authorized him to offer the parent tract for no less than $7.7 million.
There was no authorization from the partnership. Mr. Baker testified he was a friend of Jamie Reynolds. There was no signed agreement. Mr. Reynolds was ill and unable to testify during the trial. But the bottom line is fair market value was never in play when you have people who have Linger Longer that's in receivership and the Reynolds in receivership desperately needing cash, so they didn't lose this land without at least getting something for it.
Can I clarify a response? I believe to, if I understood the chief's question, that the Reynolds had been selling parcels along the way, and the tax court specifically finds the sale of four parcels that are all around the amount of $1 million. So can you just clarify how it is that if indeed they were selling parcels for about that amount but then jumped to over $10 million for a value?
Well, that would depend on the acreage and the highest and best use. Plus, they were in receivership when they were selling a lot of those. And you'll notice from the record that the bank was reviewing the sale to make sure they could get a sufficient value so they didn't take further action to go ahead and take the property. The other thing I would like to talk about, the other legal error that I would like to talk about, because I do believe the qualified appraisal is a legal error because the court did not look at what reasonable people would do, and that's the definition of fair market value. I would like to talk about the inventory issue, because this is another one where they've moved.
When someone doesn't act reasonably in driving and causes an accident on the road, that's a finding of fact. I mean, I've got to tell you, I think this is a finding of fact that they didn't get a qualified appraisal.
Well, I think then our briefs establish clear error in that point because he should have considered what a reasonable person would have done.
Okay.
Not what he's inferred from information that wasn't even properly admitted into the record.
What's the other point you wanted to make?
The other point I want to make is this new inventory rule that has come around. It wasn't a rule when I tried Champions Retreat. It wasn't a rule in Palmer Ranch. It's a new rule. And what the government's trying to do here is they're trying to say a qualified conservation contribution is inventory. A qualified conservation contribution is a non-possessory property interest. Even the government in their own briefs show that under Georgia law, it's a non-possessory interest. Inventory is defined as property held primarily for sale to customers in the ordinary course of a taxpayer's trade or business. It's got to be property, and you've got to anticipate severing title. So this is a non-possessory interest, and we still owned it. We still owned it after the trial. So it can't possibly meet the definition of inventory under the code. Furthermore, if you look at subsection 170B, it defines the contribution limits for qualified conservation contributions.
I think we understand that part of your argument, Ms. Hoard.
Okay.
Let's hear from Mr. Rennie.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Douglas Rennie for the Commissioner. As Your Honor's questioning indicated, there were numerous attempts to sell this property by Mercer and Jamie Reynolds. They were prominent developers in the area. They sold different property, they developed property, and that's what they were trying to do with this property here, whether in the context of a joint venture or through a sale from Mr. Baker, the broker, who did authorize Mr. Thwaite to quote that $7.7 million price to a prospective buyer. And this all showed that only 9 months before this donation, this $7.7 million prospective offer was solicited. And they ended up valuing this at $50 million for the purpose of the easement. And that wasn't an accident. That's what the evidence shows here, as Your Honor's questioning correctly shows. To address some of the points, my colleague...
tell me this. Do you think that the determination by the tax court that there was not a qualified appraisal is a finding of fact?
Yes, Your Honor, we agree with that
point. And so your the evidence that you just pointed to, you would say, means this can't be clearly erroneous.
Correct, Your Honor. And
if that's true, we don't have to go further?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. That shows that any reasonable person in this circumstance, knowing that they had offered the property for sale at this amount, knowing that they had been trying to enter into joint ventures with these valuations, would have recognized that this property is not worth anywhere close to $50 million or $60 million, what some of these valuations have.
Even in the $7 to $9 million range, they couldn't get it sold.
Correct. Correct, Your Honor. Yes. And now my colleague mentioned that this regulation is suspect under the APA. They have never challenged the regulation here. That's not an issue in this case. She suggested that the Reynoldses were distressed owners, but Mercer Reynolds testified that they were not affected by the receivership after 2012, and we do know that they entered into a joint venture with the TPA group, a smaller one in the Traditions parcel, so it wasn't like no one else was willing to enter into a deal with them.
Does this really depend on the regulation? Because it seemed to me that the statute requires a qualified appraisal, and if this was a finding of fact that this tract was worth considerably less than $10 million, and that the appraisal had to be close to $60 million, I would think that regulation aside, a tax court could make a finding of fact that this was not a qualified appraisal.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, we agree with you. The other...
because it would be effectively then a sham.
Yes. Yes. And some of the other points my colleague mentioned, she suggested that they couldn't tell what evidence the court was relying on here. The court had a very thorough opinion. It quoted a lot of the documents at issue. A lot of the evidence was cited specifically in my colleague's briefs below to the court. She suggested that offers do not establish value. So those cases that discuss that are really talking about fact that you cannot use offers as a substitute for comparable sales in evaluating a fair market value, but we're talking about offers that the parties here said they would accept for this very property.
Right.
To discuss the inventory rule came up at the end. If the court reaches that, which it doesn't need to, if it agrees that there were not qualified appraisers here, an easement is an interest in property under Georgia law and otherwise. And you know whether you were to dispose of it by virtue of putting an easement on the property or giving fee simple title to 300 acres instead of 350, we would submit that's a disposition either way. And otherwise, I welcome the court's questions.
I think we understand your case, Mr. Rennie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ward, you've saved 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I'm going to respectfully disagree again about the qualified appraisal. The court seems to be relying on evidence of a distressed seller trying to monetize the assets they have. And the Supreme Court's already said you can't use that. You can't use that. That's not a willing seller under no compulsion to sell because they're about to lose this property. So I respectfully disagree on that point. Plus, I would like to point out, if you actually read some of the emails, it's very clear that Strategic always said, we have to wait on seeing what the appraisers value this property as. If you look at exhibit, it's exhibit 271R. Even Mr. Freeman says, you have to wait and see what the appraisers come up with.
Yeah, because they wanted to make sure it was going to be sufficient for the Reynolds is to net $7 million.
Well, the Reynolds know what their property, what they want to get out of their property. They can't, but the problem is, Your Honor, they can't, think about fair market value. Yeah. Maybe I own a parking lot next door. What's its worth as a parking lot? It's one thing. What's its worth as a business? A building that rents property, it's different. The issue here is what is the highest and best use of this property? And it certainly wasn't what Mr. Driggers said it was. He said whole for luxury housing. Last month I was here arguing in front of a different panel, and they changed the goalpost there too. I had a prior sale for $60 million of the same property, but it was 32 months earlier. If you look at Mr. Driggers' appraisal here, four of his seven comparables are more than that, and the government's taking the flip side.
We're not deciding this de novo. This isn't a trial court. The tax court has heard the evidence and made findings that we're reviewing. And the question we have to decide is whether its view of the evidence, which might have been different from how we would have viewed it had we heard it as a trial court, is clearly erroneous.
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to say it's clearly erroneous when you look at all of the other evidence. To say that it's not clearly erroneous is to say, well, the hospital authority didn't know what they were doing putting a hospital here. The school board, the county didn't know what they were doing to issue a bond and put a school here. That, you know, the county was stupid to put a fire station here. There's a lot of development in the area, and anybody who's been there would notice that the infrastructure has already been placed in the area because it was the next parcel to be developed. So you've got to look at the highest and best use. And also, under the regulations, he's supposed to do what a reasonable person would do.
Okay.
And I don't believe that occurred here, with all due respect.
Okay. I think we understand your argument, Ms. Ford, and we appreciate it. We're going to move on to our next case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.